So let's talk about sex. In a particular way, the Buddhist tradition, like all of the great contemplative traditions, gives a substantial amount, in a certain way, of attention to sexual energy as a force in the world. In a sense, all of the great traditions in some way offer structures with which to organize, in a sense, or put boundaries on, in many ways, this force. The guideline to wise action in relation to sexuality is the third of the five Buddhist precepts or ethical guidelines. The way it's chanted is with the words kame sumichachara, and embedded in kame sumichachara, kama is the word for desire or lust. So very specific to not so much just sexuality in general, but the precept is really talking about an energy of longing or wanting or an urge that most of us, I will assume, are quite familiar with toward sexual expression or activity, however that manifests. And one of the things that's beautiful in the Buddhist tradition is that there's not a picture painted about what kind of sexuality or model of relationship is considered wholesome and others considered unwholesome. It's quite, in a sense, an open tradition in its imagination around what sexual expression could look like. The examples the Buddha gives tend to be heteronormative, but don't condemn anything. What the prohibition simply says is, sometimes it's translated as not having sex with the wrong person is keeping the precept on wise sexuality. So that's fairly straightforward. And in a sense, it's open enough that it can admit a wide range of experiences. When the Buddha talks about suffering or distress, he talks about a process in which contact with the world through the senses gives rise in every moment to experiences that are either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And that every sensory contact, images seen through the eye, sounds heard with the ears, scents, tastes, physical sensations, and emotional and mental contact, considered to be a kind of contact, all come with what we can call a valence, or like a charge. And mostly we don't notice that charge, but we react to it, right? We have that gentle sense of like, I kind of like the color of the floor, and I kind of dislike the way the ceiling acoustical panels are imprecisely hung over there, and I like I like when the blankets are folded neatly, and I like when my friends come to satsang, and I dislike when, you know, loud trucks go by, etc. Every tiniest thing, right? Right. Oh, my feet are a little warm. I very slightly dislike it. But the feeling of the breeze as I move my hand through the air is slightly cool, and oh, I like it. And there's this tiny little ping of I like that and I don't like that, or it's neutral and I don't notice it. And that the sages in this tradition understood that, in a sense, reflex of assessment is going on all the time. And it's autonomic. You can't stop it. And I now will essentially say that it's part of our autonomic nervous system responding to the environment as an assessment of threat or safety, right? It's part of the it's part of the self-preservation system. And of course, zooming into an aspect of the self-preservation system is the urge to procreate. So one aspect of sexuality that comes out as the desire to make more humans, which I've just done, apparently. There's this little human crawling around the floor of the house now. And besides that, he's tremendously cute and all sorts of things, including, as of this week, very mobile. And so, you know, finding all the wires and, you know, chewing on wires. I'm like, ah, don't chew on wires, you know. But really, like, every day at some point, I look at him and he's doing his thing. He's, like, smiling and beaming. And I'm kind of like, wow. We made a person, right? Like, you're real. You're an actual human being. No matter what I do from this point, you have a life that goes on from here. God willing, it goes on for a long time. And sometimes my sweetheart will say to me, look at him. That is sex. Right? Like, straight up. You have sex, and that appears. Or we had sex, and that appeared. And it's really, it sort of flips me to be like, oh, humans are sex. Everyone exists because some sex happened. And then we have a long conversation where, like, there are now some kids who are not part of that club, and there's, like, a whole sort of, like, sex didn't happen, but things were combined in sterile containers. And it's mysterious talking about, you know, oh, there's going to be a whole new generation of kids who are, like, you know, they're already out there. They're already chatting with each other in preschool, being like, my donor is such and such, and then I have a this, and I have a that, and I have, you know, I have two moms and two dads and a donor. And the other kids are like, cool, I have two dads and one mom and three aunties, and I live with my, you know, my grandfathers, whatever, you know. Like, there's all these things. All of that is to say, back to the model. Sense impressions contact the world. They give rise to a ping of pleasant and unpleasant. And based in that ping, we either are drawn to the pleasant or pull away from the unpleasant. And throughout the texts, the languaging and metaphors used for that attraction impulse are not universally kind of sexual attraction metaphors, but very, very often they are. And often the sensual desire hindrance or urge is was simply translated as lust, right? Which maybe is imprecise. It was the early Victorian translators. They were like, oh yeah, that's lust. It might have more beneficially been translated as, you know, the urge for continued sensual contact. Sensual meaning not sexy, but just through the senses in any way. The desire to continue pleasurable contact is a kind of lustfulness. So then, sexual lustfulness, in a sense, is one of the most powerful and action-compelling impulses that we have. That's part of this family of responses to external sensory information. Sexuality in our world is both, for many people, some of the absolute most intense pleasurable experiences that we can have. It can also, and not separate from that, because there's so much of an urge for it, it is also very tragically the base energy around which a vast amount of harm is done. And they go together. There's a way that if we look at so many kinds of harm and celebration, in the world that there's an aspect of an urge for sexual contact embedded in it. So the beauty of that intense desire force that moves in us that we can call beautiful when it's aimed at an appropriate person or object. And I mean object not in the kind of distancing, objectifying, depersonalizing way, but almost simply in a kind of self-other kind of way. Self-other as the necessary components of romance, right? That in order to fall in love with something or someone, we have to see them as separate from ourselves. So some of the most powerful force that looks out from a subject position onto the world and says, I like that, I like it a lot, I like it intensely a lot, and a whole thing happens. That same force, right, can be profoundly confusing, which I don't know if you remember being a teenager, but was probably profoundly confusing at some point. And for many, that profound confusion, again, tragically, leads to harm. Leads to harm. Deludes the mind, especially when mixed with other forms of delusion, other forms of fear and hatred. And so we have a few, in a sense, layered instructions around this force from the contemplative traditions, from the Buddhist tradition specifically. One is to respect its power as kind of the most intense force around, and to then practice with this force in ourselves in a way that leans toward the wholesome. Leans toward the wholesome. So another way of saying that is to say, here we are animals with this profoundly moving energy in us. We can either do well with it or not. And it's a kind of fire. It warms, it cooks, it heats, it makes things happen, it makes people happen, and it burns. And I would guess that we've all been burned at some point by it. One of the things that's mysterious about working with sexuality in a contemplative way, first of all, is that it arises both as an internal or fully personal energy or feeling, and it's relational. So it's not just how you feel, but it's how you feel in community or in relationship with others. And that makes it a very complicated practice, because other people. Right? So because, of course, Sartre was only half right. He said hell is other people. Heaven is also other people. The trouble is you can't always tell which you're in. And it changes all the time. So, as an internal energy, part of the practice is to, as we do with any strong emotion, mindfulness practice or awareness practice with strong feeling that might be, or might be, that you could call sexual energy. In a way, it's just energy, but it's useful to understand that it often in ourselves arises with a sexual tone to it. That even in ourselves, there's practice to allow that energy to move in a way that is wholesome or nourishing or giving rise to well-being for us. And there's ways to move it that don't give rise to well-being or even that give rise to harm or distress. And because we no longer, hopefully, live in as much of a Puritan society as this country used to be, still is in some ways, but especially in a place like this, in a bubble of tolerance, it's really up to each of us to feel for ourselves what wholesome means with this energy, right? You may not be subject to overt messages, you know, that like thinking these kinds of thoughts is good and these kind of thoughts are sinful, et cetera, right? But it's subtler than that now. We feel in ourselves urges, energies, heat, vibration. Very often these come with thoughts and images. And one of the clearest places for practice is discerning the difference, for instance, between sensation, emotion, and image in the mind, for instance. Or discerning the difference between feeling an energy in the body and obsessing on a story in the mind. Right? So one thing that can happen is, you know, some feeling comes in, often quite pleasurable, and then the thinking mind, the story mind goes, ah, I've got something to say about this. And, you know, and his name is Juan Carlos, and he works at the, you know, da-da-da. And you know, maybe I should go for a coffee, because then maybe he's there. You know, whatever it is, like the mind can go into a story where the story is actually hinged on a kind of grasping, right? And it's the way we can notice that is that it's in a way disembodied, right? It's not about what's actually here. And so the practice with internal feeling or energy is, as with all the intense emotions, to come out of the story and to connect with body, right? To be like, ah, the fantasy about Juan Carlos. It's very nice, thank you very much, Juan Carlos. Set him aside, him or her, whoever it is for you, and come into the body. And this takes some doing, because those fantasies, which is essentially what they are themselves pleasurable. They are themselves pleasurable sense contact. And so we want to stay in contact with them. Well, like, you know, I could say this. I could, maybe he's wearing that shirt. You know, and each one of those thoughts and visual images in the mind gives a little ping of pleasure. And so then there's a gravity or a hypnosis to the story. The practice to become mindful of the feelings of desire is to set aside the fantasy story and image, if we can, and to come into bodily contact. So, okay, this is desire. First, name it, right? Rumpelstiltskin is always the first practice. Name the figure that's haunting you. And it's not random that he's a demon, right? That haunts a young woman and wants to steal her child. Like, it's a deep, terrible, weird story. But naming him does it. That's the thing, right? You name him, his power is gone. And it's that way with all the afflictive emotions. And in this case, I'm treating lust as an afflictive emotion. Because, not because it's bad in itself, but because what it's doing is it's taking me out of myself. It's taking me away into a kind of fantasy realm where the gravity is toward grasping rather than toward awareness. So as soon as I notice that, I say, ah, this is desire, this is lust for Juan Carlos, and well-founded because he is very handsome. But now I will set that aside, come into the body, and what do I find? And I'm going to find some collection of sensations, whatever it is for you. There's vibration, there's heat, there's gatherings of sensation at different places in the body. There's often subtly, but quite fully what we would call a global state. And if we can connect with it, the global state is often also quite pleasurable, right? And again, here's a choice point. Pure, in a sense, awareness practice. In other words, if you want to just understand this force, the practice continues to be, don't do anything about it, right? Just tune your awareness to it and really try to sense it in its fullness. Oh, it's vibrating, it's warm, it's pleasurable. Include the fact that it's pleasurable in your awareness practice. And what it's going to do is it's going to crest and release. It's going to crest and fade, not in any dramatic way generally, it just settles. You'll notice that if you keep the fantasy going, it doesn't settle. And that's part of a little feedback loop that we get into with an energy like sexual desire, that thought and sensation can feed into each other. Right? And of course, the world we live in, the lovely American consumer world, really loves when we have a little bit of this feeling moving through us kind of all the time. Right? We get flashed images of pretty pictures everywhere. Images of pretty pictures. Images of pretty people, right? Everywhere. And there's all sorts of critique to be made of that, right? There's a vast majority of those pretty pictures are tilted toward toward being offered only to a male gaze rather than a female gaze. There's a vast majority tilting toward a heteronormative gaze or a thin normative gaze or a white normative gaze. All of these frames or limitations on what is basically a primal energy coursing through everybody, or we could say in a tantric way, everything. But our culture flashes us these little nuggets of like, think this way, feel this way, and there's the sense that like, oh, they are attractive in some way. They want to ping your system, or they're trying to be attractive. They want to ping your system into staying in that loop. Thought feeling, thought feeling, thought feeling. Again, the escape from them, in a way, and this is a basic renunciation, is to close your eyes. Take a moment. Oh, I close my eyes. Pause. I remember about 15 years ago, I was biking along Market Street, and this was right about a time when I think it was Abercrombie and Fitch, this massive store on Market Street. And they were going through a whole phase of basically like just fully nude bodies. Like there's not even any clothes in their ads anymore. It's just bodies, pretty bodies. And they had filled like floor, like two-story windows on the outside of their store with kind of three or four essentially naked bodies, both male and female, all white, which they eventually got a lawsuit for. Good for them. And I remember biking along and almost getting in an accident because I was just like these huge kind of sexy bodies shining out at me. And I was like, wow, I'm trying to deal with muni tracks and buses and everything. And finally, I just pulled over and I stopped and I closed my eyes. I was practicing a lot at the time. And I was like, wow, and I could just feel the way that the images had like, you know, had put like a dart into my heart for a moment. And I was just like kind of stunned. Not even that like they were particularly my kind of person, but you know, they're pretty people. And I was like, wow, I was just biking along, kind of being in my space, being present to my body and the physicality of biking. And I just got like blown away by this kind of lust crossbow, you know, and I just stopped and I was like, whoa, and I put the images out of my mind and I just felt my whole body kind of vibrate for a while until it settled. And I was like, oh, that's crazy that they're allowed to do that. Right. So that's the practice internally. Set aside image and story, tune into body and allow the feeling to crest and release. So then let's go to others, right? So many of the traditions frame a conversation around sexuality essentially around what are the appropriate boundaries or containments for this energy. And so much in our culture and every culture, one could in some ways say the core organizing principle of any culture is how to organize sexuality, right? The rules about marriage, the rules about property, the rules about who lives where and who lives with who, are in many, many ways all guidelines, mores to channel this force. Right? Almost, I don't know of a single society that leaves this force unchanneled or unshaped in some way, usually many, many ways. And so there's then the practice of either going with or resisting your culture's boundaries around that thing. And this gets into a conversation really about, right, in the same way that with internally we're talking about what's wholesome for me in relation to this energy, I'm going to ask myself, what's wholesome in relation to my culture? And I grew up in the 80s in America, where there was strangely, simultaneously, right, a profusion of sexual imagery around in the movies and the music and everything. And at the same time, a very Puritan kind of hatred of the body, hatred of the feminine, fear of sexuality thing happening. You know, social politics in this country is you know, it's about what? The obsessions of the right wing in this country, outside of the fiscal, which we could probably trace to sexuality as well, but, you know, are like, oh, the governing of abortion and the governing of marriage and the governing of homosexuality and the policing of who we can get together with and where and how and what happens from that. And or what the Pope endearingly called. He said, we have to get away from pelvic issues. That was the term, pelvic, like, sort of, like, encompass the whole range of the obsessions of the Christian right as pelvic issues, like, kind of says it. Why the obsession with sexuality? Why is it all about that? What would our country be like? What would any culture be like if all of those particular obsessions were resolved? If we add to that the harm caused by sexuality, if we said, what if we were a culture where, you know, maybe there's still fear and hatred and greed and people stole stuff, but what if there was, what if we came to the end of rape and sexual abuse and sexual harassment? And we can get a sense of how profoundly the misuse and the obsession with sexual energy shapes everything we do here. Whatever gender you are, whatever you do, whether you identify as any kind of sexual, including asexual, right, which wouldn't be a sexual identity if it wasn't in the middle of a culture that's obsessed with sexuality. You could just choose to not be that interested in sex. But that's such a thing here, that it is an identity of its own that needs to be defended, right, against an onslaught of oppression, like all of the non-normative identities. So culturally, the force is to contain this, is to channel this. And then for each of us, there's the practice of finding what is wholesome expression of this primal force for ourselves. And I mentioned this aspect partly in solidarity with a couple of friends of mine who, a couple of weeks ago, over at the Queer Sangha at East Bay Meditation Center, were going to go in and talk about sexuality, particularly around defending and making spaces for queer sexualities in the face of heteronormative oppression as a way to reduce suffering, dukkha, around sexuality. And they were going to give that talk right on the right after the crime in Orlando happened, and so with them I want to bring in an orientation toward the the intensity of the harm caused by misuse or delusion, confusion, fear around sexuality, but then the need for, as contemplatives, as practitioners, whether we ourselves practice a heteronormative or non-heteronormative sexuality, to be strong allies of freedom of self-definition in relation to sexuality as an important piece in decreasing suffering. To go back to the basic equation, that through our senses we come into contact with the external world that pings or has a valence of being either pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, and the pleasant of a certain flavor, particularly in relation to other people, can hook into this natural urge that manifests as sexuality. What we have is a system that simultaneously then can be the site of the most beautiful experiences we can have in this life, some of the most beautiful experiences, and some of the most profound suffering. And our media is full of depictions of both, right? Our media, our movies and stories are full of the myth of finding the perfect sexual partner. Maybe that's a vast percentage of the stories we take in are about finding the perfect partner, getting them, attaining this partner. And and then the profound heartbreak that results from that story not manifesting. Right? And like any counselor, I think, half of my practice is full of people tormented by not finding their partner or tormented by the partner they're with. Because, of course, if you find them, it just changes the flavor of your Sartrean dilemma, right? First, your whole life was about finding them. Now your whole life is about dealing with them. And as the Buddhist tradition developed into the gorgeous tantric unfoldings in the Himalayas, Buddhist sages began to depict, along with their Shaiva neighbors in Kashmir, began to depict absolute reality as an act of lovemaking between pure consciousness and form, where the yogis would then visualize an image of the Buddha and a female Buddha, so a male and female Buddha figure, seated upright in sexual union, in ecstasy, and wrapping together the images of pure awareness and pure ecstatic form. So turning into a divine image, that basic experience that we have, that there is awareness, and through the senses there's contact with form, and that form explodes awareness in a way that it desires. And so then yogis began to visualize this as the sexual act and imagine in themselves both of those poles of the energy. This is a way that renunciations, in the earliest traditions, the practice was just renunciation, right? Just don't look at the pretty people, right? You're a monk or a nun, just keep your eyes down. And honestly, it will save you from a lot of distress. Right? What, you're not monks and nuns at the moment, as far as I can tell, but whatever for you, containment works to decrease suffering. This is a containment worth practicing. Right? So part of what I do, I'm biking around, and there's everything is around, there's pretty people. Yeah. Part of what I practice now is I practice being contained by my wedding ring. Not because I fear acting out in a way that would be hurtful to my marriage, but actually just because it's a containment that I practice with, that I enjoy practicing with, and that helps me. Right? Because I do have a tendency to just, as many of us do, I get pinged by pretty people. Oh my God, pretty person. Oh my God, pretty person. And it's like a little dart every time, just whoo, wow, whoo, wow. I happen to try to write my dissertation in a cafe in the mornings that sometimes is just maddeningly full with pretty people. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'm like, this is a terrible place to work. And I sort of wrap myself in a renunciation of gazing. And I'm just like, the world is full of pretty people, and I married one, and all is well. Like, enough. Enough. And you can really see that there's just a greed embedded in it. Like, I got my pretty person. What do I need? And anyway, if I had more, it would be very complicated. So there's not even any substance there, which is part of what the boundary teaches us. Right? If you submit to a boundary that you've chosen, whatever it is, the boundary will teach you what is skillful and unskillful. And essentially the boundary is the boundary of the skillful and the unskillful, or the wholesome and the unwholesome. So wherever you put your boundary might be, I only date three people at a time, you know? And that could be like the boundary of the wholesome, because beyond that, you just don't have enough time or, you know, memory on your SIM card to deal with everybody that's coursing through your life. So you're like, oh, I can't be in relationship in a way that I value or respect if I exceed this boundary. So whatever it is for you, the boundary is the practice of discerning wholesome from unwholesome or skillful from unskillful. So know what your boundary is, whatever it is. Know what you choose. Boundary, of course, is also a way to exclude that which is unskillful or harmful from you, necessary in this world, unfortunately. So the early practice of renunciation, which boundary is, turned into, in the tantric period, the practice of, we could say, sublimation or absorption. So saying, it's not just that I have a boundary where, like, that which feels unwholesome or distracting or like chaos in my nervous system, I'm going to exclude from my senses. But actually, I'm going to turn that energy inward, not by even thinking about pretty people, but actually thinking about a sort of imagined, rarefied, energetic form of that. And I'm going to, in a sense, do that initial practice. I'm going to set aside fantasy. I'm going to fold the fantasy into a pure image, right, of two Buddhas making love, right? Buddha and consort making love. And I'm going to turn that image just into light inside my being. But I'm going to do that by whipping up, in a sense, or connecting with the energy that's here, right? And similar to that first example of tune into the body, the energy crests and releases. In some of the tantric practices, you'll tune into the body and invite the energy to grow, but not to grow in a way that encourages grasping or craving, right? Not to hook it into a fantasy or a make-believe realm, but to stay in the real contact with energy and allow that energy to build in a way that, again, is bounded by what the awareness of what is skillful or wholesome. So I'll end with just coming back to this basic practice. We move through the world, and our senses, our hearts, in a way, are open And the open heart or the open gaze or open ears, the open body to the world, receives wanted and unwanted stimulus all the time. And that wanted or unwanted stimulus is pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And that which we call lust or sensual desire or sexual desire is a way of speaking to, in a way, like some of the most fiery or hook-laden energies that are out there in relation to sensory contact. And then the practice, in a sense, is the same as with any sensory contact, only more so, only more heightened, right? Because the fire is that much hotter. The pleasure is that much greater. The potential for harm is equally great. So, as a start for that, thank you. Responses, reflections, questions. We'll have a few minutes for discussion. What do you think about when we open this realm?
It's complicated.
It sure is. It sure is. What's particularly complicated to you?
Well, you know, our social mores, our bodily reactions, mm-hmm. our interactions with other people,
yeah.
our relationships. It's just, it's always, it plays into so much of our being and days
yeah.
and,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, it plays into kind of everything.
Everything.
So how do you practice with it? Like, what do you do to... in a sense, be with that.
It's fun. Well, yeah, it's so funny. Especially as a woman, like the hormonal surges, right? Mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, depending on what time of the month it is, how much mm-hmm. I'm paying attention to.
Absolutely.
It's like I'm ovulating, I'm very aware of sexuality and yep. how my body feels and other people.
Yeah.
And that's such a interesting way to deal with the world sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And other times, it just doesn't, you know, not there, really.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, my partner is gone for 7 days at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's home for 7 days, and then he's gone for 7 days. And that is a very interesting way to live with sexuality as well.
Right.
You know, he's just not around.
Whatever your body's doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Partner's there or not.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and so I'm pretty... in my own world, in my own relationships, pretty aware of the somehow the disconnect
mm.
constantly going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
I have a pretty healthy relationship with sex and sexuality, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't raised with really any shame around it.
Yeah.
You know, hippie parents and
God bless.
The Bay Area, you know.
Totally. Totally. It ain't a small thing.
It
to
is.
Escape
no, I
that.
Feel very blessed that I am. It's not something that I have ever really struggled with.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Realizing that I was bisexual somewhere in high school, it was like, oh well, that's
yeah.
interesting.
Uh huh. Totally. Totally.
You know, and how that you know works into my monogamous marriage now to a man, and you know it's all interesting. And
I love that new word. I want them to like put it in the, you know, in the OED soon. Monogamous.
Monogamous, you know.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah.
You know, it's really it's good.
It's Yiddish.
It's Yiddish.
It is.
Yeah, no, for
it's
sure.
Mostly, you know, and I think for most people, it's the default because it's easiest because the other options are so complicated.
Yeah. Yeah.
And take a lot of work.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well,
right.
And. Everything takes a lot of work,
yes.
right? But yeah, in part, what we're talking about, you know, is an evolving social understanding of what wholesome is. And, you know, the fact that monogamish is essentially accepted now in some circles,
mm-hmm.
you know, yeah, you know, go back to your family in Ohio or something and tell them about your nice bisexual monogamish lifestyle, and, you know. You know, the fact that it's accepted only shines, you know, into stark relief the places where it's not, you know, and we can really realize how, like, yeah, those, the social boundaries around this essentially most intimate basic human energy force feeling are profoundly complicated, mm-hmm. you know, not because they're in themselves complicated, I think, but just because it's fire and people are afraid, you know, and there's a lot of, because the boundary is the sign of knowing what's wholesome and unwholesome, there's a lot of different ideas about what that boundary should be, you know, and fear tends to make boundaries narrower.
It is mostly, and so complicated because we've, you know, it's something that builds in our society and our families and then gets more complicated as we go out in the world and interact with people and then continues.
Truly.
Because it is the other people that's really the problem with sex. It's a complication.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can all go home and watch this Sarah Silverman video called The Perfect Night. Which is a very funny a little send up of this whole thing. Look it up. Other thoughts while we're here, please.
Something you said made me start thinking about the ways in which our responses to the sort of, I forget the words you used of not righteous and not righteous, but what are the two? Like skillful or unskillful?
I use either skillful, unskillful, or wholesome, unwholesome.
Wholesome and unwholesome, and feeling in response to those boundaries being set for us by our culture.
Yeah.
There's kind of a pushback, and then I find, at least in my life, and I'm thinking of an example also from a friend's life, of sort of overcorrecting in response to pushing off those boundaries, and then sort of like losing any boundaries by sort of like resisting the external boundaries. So,
sure.
For example, I have a close friend who was telling me that he feels almost, he's gay, and when he travels, he feels almost like he has sex, like, out of control, because he's
mm-hmm.
pushing against these boundaries in other cultures, because he's constantly getting triggered by the different cultures and positions and like, secrecy around it, that he kind of, like, goes on Tinder immediately when he lands in an airport, and ends up hooking up with people, and doesn't feel bad about it, sort of feels like he's taking a stand, and, like, bringing more, like, gayness to the world, I guess.
Which, you know, the world could use a little more gayness.
Right.
Of course, of course.
But then there's that sense of, like, maybe slipping off that edge of
Well, this is really what distinguishes, in a sense, a practitioner's way from the way of someone who is reacting to the world from a place of, say, ego, which is that, like, pushing against external boundaries is a fine practice. The practitioner's way is no matter what is happening, no matter what I'm doing, to continually return to an inquiry around what is actually wholesome, what is conducive to well-being. And so in a sense, like, there's all sorts of things that cultures do that deserve being pushed against. But how I personally push up against them, I hold my practice at a higher value, so deeper in my heart than the need to push in a certain way, because I value well-being, right? And so I'm like, oh, and this is edgy, because in a certain way, there are some things that I'm not going to push up against in order to keep myself safe, or those that I love safe, right? There's moments to push and moments not to push. But it asks us, practice asks us to find ways to both increase the general righteousness in society, but also to maintain our own inner compass toward well-being. And well-being in the Buddhist sense really means toward the end of suffering. So then the question again and again would be, okay, there's desire. Is moving toward this desire in this moment conducive to well-being for everybody, right? And in the tiniest way, right? When I'm walking down the street and I meet eyes with someone, there's a choice of whether to keep that eye contact for 2 seconds or to let it go. And that choice is going to be a choice of whether it's wholesome or unwholesome. right? And we all know what that choice point is like. Is this a moment where maintaining contact and pinging that energy is going to give rise to well-being for each person here or not? And if it's not, if one person thinks it's going to and another person thinks it's not going to, which unfortunately is very common, mm-hmm. right? The person who thinks it's going to's practice will have to be to learn more empathy, to learn to be attuned and say, oh, I want this, but it's not received. Right, renunciation. Mm-hmm. Right, because to override renunciation is aggression. Right, so then there's a balance there. But this happens in micro moments. Is this wholesome? Is this unwholesome?
Yeah, and it feels complicated because it's like sometimes there's no clear distinction in your feeling of discomfort of is this a shame reaction of what I'm told?
Yeah.
Should be feel uncomfortable, or is it like a real moral compass of like I'm being, you know, for example, around especially like as women and trying to like push the boundaries of the ways in which we're confined and mm-hmm. being told of being a good or moral woman, and then mm-hmm. even in relationship, like monogamish relationships, what discomfort is shame around what you feel you're supposed to do, and what discomfort is actually your internal, someone might get hurt or the fire might burn somebody.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's complicated.
It sure is complicated. There's no substitute for self-inquiry. Right, like you have to. No external assessment can answer that for you, because it's going to be different for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you're going to be like, you know, I'm drawn to this kind of oppression. I feel these kinds of oppressions. I'm drawn to this kind of expression. I feel these kinds of oppressions, and this is my best guess for today as to what my clear moral compass is. And one day you're like, oh, that feels totally right. And at another time you're like, oh, wait, I think that's shame talking, right? And it's subtle, right? Because those, especially shame, right, gets embedded in us so deeply from so early that it takes a lot to disentangle. And it takes, like any trauma, a very safe space to disentangle, right? And so, you know, speaking about being a woman in this culture, expressing, this is generally sort of as a baseline not a safe space. And so then how do you figure that out if there's not a safe space to actually live into it in a way that you can know yourself, right? And so then we try to build safe spaces. This is what like ally spaces are for, and ways that we want to make spaces welcoming for folks to find their practitioner compass, right, and to unlearn kind of oppression stories, right? And that's a huge task, right, both for those oppressed and for our allies to figure out how to do together. Yeah, so it's 9:17. We'll say that our conversation is formally over. And did you want to jump in with one thing, and then we'll close after we hear?
I wanted to flag that under the umbrella construct of,
yep.
you started out with, let's talk about sex.
Yes.
That you brought in the, under the category of unwholesome.
Yep.
And oppressions, you talked about rape and sexual assault.
Yes.
And I wanted to flag that my preferred framework mm-hmm. is that rape and sexual assault aren't crimes of sexuality or sex,
uh-huh.
but they're aggressions, they're crimes of violence
yes.
that in a sexualized culture manifest
yes.
in a certain way. And that there's a lot
yeah.
of stuff for people around like, oh, this was a sexual thing.
Right.
When in fact it
right.
wasn't. It was like
absolutely.
Getting hit on the head with a baseball bat, but in a sexualized culture,
yes.
manifesting in a what could be a
absolutely
articulated as a sexualized way.
Absolutely, this is important. Thank you for flagging that. It's absolutely true. I include them as unwholesome because there's a sexual aspect in them, but very much if we're talking about the impulse very often, right, there's an anger or hatred or aggression impulse that's there. And in a sense, it's a, like you're saying very beautifully, it's a symptom of a hypersexualized culture.
And a misogynistic culture and a patriarchal culture. And so it's an easy avenue.
Yes.
For anger and hatred and aggression.
Yes.
But in fact, it's not actually about sex.
For sure. So. For sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. And in a completely heartbreaking way, this expression of hatred and fear and anger, you know, is part of every war ever. Right? Like, it's actually just a weapon of war. It's not particularly connected to desire at all.
Right.
Right. And so, shows a way that this activity connected to this beautiful intimate energy actually just gets so perverted and infiltrates into everything that it infiltrates even our most horrifying acts of war and violence. So that's absolutely true. Thank you for that. All right. So thank you for being in an interesting conversation, and there's always more there. As always, we're fully on donation. Your generosity supports us to offer this group and invite everyone to it. Living in a gift economy kind of way. Thanks for your generosity. Donations go in the basket. We'll continue. Summer teaching includes philosophy intensives at the Yoga Garden, two of them, one spread out over 3 months, one a six-day retreat. Check in with me if you're into those things. And onward. And blessings to everyone. Happy solstice. And we'll see you soon.